From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. And we are podcasting in the middle of a snowstorm. I know it's news. It's going to snow like 2 feet this weekend. That's news.
That's definitely news. If you have good snow pictures, send them our way. Our news director, Randy Gorman, wants to record the progress this weekend with you shoveling out your driveway. So
I know. Everybody's on this push-pull like, we're Rochester. This isn't news. But then it's like, well, it's a lot of snow. So
remember the ice storm? Were you here for the ice storm in the 90s?
Yeah, not in the 90s. I was here for the ice storm in 2003. In fact, I'd been here for 2 weeks in 2003, and people are like, oh, you missed the winter. Lucky you. And then we had an ice storm, and 400,000 people were without power.
Welcome to Rochester.
Yeah, so the bottom line is we're saying this before the snow comes, and we hope it doesn't turn into something more serious because then we're going to look like we don't care. But let's start this week's conversation on the podcast with a very serious conversation. It's about race, a conversation about how to have conversations about race. Now, a few months ago, Jackie Campbell from the Children's Agenda came to WXXI to lead a session about the subject. And Megan and I attended that discussion, and we learned a lot. I mean, there was really a powerful day at WXXI. Jackie's session led to some really strong emotional breakthroughs, and we wanted her to share how she does that with our listeners.
One of the questions Jackie asked us and our colleagues to consider was when in our lives we first became aware of the concept of race. It led to a conversation about white racelessness. So in this clip, Jackie explains why she asks that question.
I think the question for different people will have a different response. And what happens for people of color, and also specifically for black people, is that when we ask a group to think about when they've heard about race, the onus typically falls on people of color. Because one of the myths that holds up supremacy and privilege is this the myth of white racelessness. So if you are not deliberately asked to think about it, then you think when you hear about race, you think about the other. So people of color typically have already thought and processed this, but white people have not. And one of the things that happened in the space is that we ask people to think about it and to talk about it and then to share. But the people who were sharing were only people of color. So then you ask white people, what is the response or why they're not speaking? And it comes down to what Alan said. It's sort of like, well, I don't want to say the wrong thing. But also that many times when they learn about the way that they experience or have talked about experiencing racism has to do with people who are in their group, but in order to disclose it, you have to disclose something about a family member or disclose something about someone who is close to you. So I mentioned that we have the conversation about white people all the time. I go home like, this happened to me today. Let me share this. So we are prepared to talk about it, but other groups are not. But when you're trying to address issues around race and racism, that you have to make other people talk about it, or else there's no conversation.
White racelessness is such a pervasive idea, and I think it's hard to understand it unless you're intentional about trying to see it. And one of my favorite podcasts is John McWhorter, who is an African-American professor of linguistics and author. And his podcast is outstanding, by the way. But he recently was saying that it's this idea that a lot of white people think, well, I speak correctly. The way I speak, our speech patterns, the language, the grammar we use is the standard. Mm-hmm. And everything else is a deviation from the standard. And wouldn't it be good if we could teach everyone to use the standard? When there is no correct, and he said, this is hard for people to understand. There is not a correct way to speak. And your way of speaking is not the standard of which we will try to drag everyone else into. And I thought, boy, that's going to be hard for a lot of people to hear.
Absolutely.
But now hearing you use the term racelessness or white racelessness, I think there's probably something that is connected there. This idea that, oh, I don't speak with an accent.
Right.
I speak correctly.
Correct.
It's just an idea that it's the standard from which everything else flows.
Right.
As opposed to why are we centering this when mm-hmm. there's lots of different ways. So that's just one thing that
Absolutely.
Came to mind for me.
And you can expand on that to point to appearance, right? So what is the norm? And everything else that is not the norm then becomes not just other, but less than. So when you lift up white racelessness, and the first time I encountered this or realized what I was encountering happened years ago, and I think I shared this at Table 23, in a class that I was in, and there was some racial issue that was happening in Rochester, like there always is. And the professor at the time said, oh, let's do an exercise. Let's write out all of the names that are offensive to black people. It was a class of about like maybe 35, and there were about like 7 or 8 of us. And, you know, we filled up one chalkboard. This is when there was chalk and no whatever it is now. But filled up one board and went to the next. And then there was, okay, now so let's write down all the words that are offensive to white people. And so, you know, we went in. We started saying a whole bunch of things. And the white people who were the majority, and they were saying, nope, that's not, no, that doesn't bother me. Nope, that nope. And what bothered the white people in the room was whenever we put white in front of whatever it was we were saying. So if we said white boy or white something, then it became a problem because the socialization process does not lift up white people as having a color, right? So the white is the norm and everything else is not something other but a deviation of that.
Yeah, here's John Mehta writing for popularresistance.org on this idea. He writes, the reality of America is that white people are supposed to be fundamentally good. And so when a white person commits a crime, it is a sign that they, as an individual,
exactly.
are bad. Their actions as a person are not indicative of any broader social construct. Even the fact that America has a growing number of violent hate groups populated mostly by white men, and that nearly all serial killers are white men, cannot shadow the fundamental truth of white male goodness. In fact, we like white serial killers so much, we make miniseries about them.
Mm.
White people are good as a whole and only act badly as individuals. And Mehta writes, people of color, especially black people, but boy, can we talk about the Mexicans in our country mm-hmm. lately, are seen as fundamentally bad and maybe individually
Absolutely.
Good.
Wow.
Powerful.
Very powerful.
Next, this was Dialogue on Disability Week here at WXXI, and we had a number of discussions about how to create more inclusive communities and workplaces. The Good Place star Jamila Jamil recently turned down a role to play a deaf woman, saying that the role should go to a deaf actress instead. She's one of several Hollywood stars speaking out about the need for more inclusion and representation of people with disabilities in the media and in the workforce.
In Rochester, a report released last year revealed that poverty and unemployment are disproportionately affecting people with disabilities. We talked to representatives from Rochester Rehabilitation about this issue. In this clip, you'll hear from Sarah Taylor, their vice president of employment. But up first, here's Joe Robinson. He's a veteran and a peer job coach at Rochester Rehab.
I came to Rochester in 2008 from the VA, and I went to the VOA for assistance, and they sent me over to Rochester Rehabilitation Center where I had job readiness training. And I was given the opportunity to volunteer there. And I worked from being a volunteer into a receptionist. And I worked for a while, and then I wanted to retire. I'm 75 years old, so I wanted to retire. And that was a few years ago. Then I decided to come back to work. So I got my resume together, put on a suit and tie, and went to a job fair, and I ran into Ms. Taylor. And she asked me, Joe, what are you doing here? I said, I want to come back to work. So she gave me the opportunity to come back to work, and I started in production, and then I wound up in being a inspector in production, and now I'm a peer job coach where I work with individuals who were previously on DHS who are now trying to find self-sufficiency through working. And it's a pleasure working in that field because I've been in situations where I wasn't able to be self-sufficient and I got the help, and now to give back is a good thing. But getting into the veterans, as far as veterans are viewed a lot of time as individuals who have some skills, but they might have problems due to combat situations. And I think people need to take another look at veterans because they all had jobs when they were in the military, and their assets, they meet challenges. People use disabilities, but everybody has challenges. And we as veterans were able to work through those challenges, mm-hmm. and so many times we are an asset to a company instead of a liability. People might look at you limp, or they might view the unseen challenges that you have, which we all have. And if you don't have a challenge or disability right now because you're young and vibrant, believe me, when you get my age or coming into my age, you will have one. So I think that we need to look at people in a positive way and give people chances. You know, we have choices. When somebody walks in the door, if you're a hiring manager, to look at that person and say, you know what, he might be able to do this job, or with accommodations, he might be able to make the company grow, you know. And when you can walk into a company and look at somebody that looks like you, no matter who you are, that gives you a feeling, I might fit in, you know. I think about Ms. Taylor yesterday. We had a graduating class from the scanning, and she was taking a picture with that class. She said, look at here. We have a variety of people here from all over. We had a Sudanese woman. We had a woman from the Far East. We had black Americans. We had white Americans. She said, look at the rainbow we have here. And it's so good to come in a company when you can see a rainbow and you can feel, you know, I like to work here because they have people of different ethnicities and people, you know, that I can blend in with, you know.
Maybe you go from no real awareness to knowing how to say the right things. Oh, you know, we care about diversity. You know, it's part of some sort of a handbook or a mantra to action. And I wonder if, are we stuck on that middle step too often now? Do you hear companies say, like you mentioned, the CEO saying, oh, you know, we care about diversity of hiring, et cetera. It's easy to say that. Are we more often stuck there as opposed to the action step of making change?
We are stuck. We are stuck with quicksand. We are stuck with super. We are just stuck. And I see it, you know, from all different levels when we talk about diversity and inclusion. Everyone wants to say the politically correct language. Everyone wants to believe their company believes in social responsibility. But the reality is your numbers tell me something different. The way your corporation looks tells me something different. So again, we have to get past the talk and really put it into action. And we're really stuck there. I mean, when you talk about diversity and inclusion, whether you're talking about individuals with disabilities or we're talking about racial diversity, it's a topic that's very, very uncomfortable. But we have to be willing to have that conversation more than just a conversation to really put some action steps in place that will move the dial.
We will end the week with a philosophical discussion about our future as it relates to tech. A number of new and evolving technologies are leading to concerns about safety and privacy. Chief among them is location sharing, where companies sell your location information to advertisers and retailers with the hope of influencing you as a consumer. Facial recognition technology is also generating conversations about privacy. The Lockport City School District is installing facial recognition software as a safety feature in its schools, despite pushback from some parents.
Our panel discussed the ethical and legal implications of these technologies and what users should know. In this clip, you'll hear from Steve Jacobs, a professor in the Department of Computing and Information Sciences at RIT, and from Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. But first, here's RIT professor of philosophy, Larry Torcello. Evan asked him how we can create a culture where we discuss if we should create new technology versus how to create that technology. Here's Larry's response.
The commercial value drives the product, and you know, the ethical concerns are often an afterthought. And you know, rather than beginning a product with a vision in mind, which of course can go wrong itself, but at least having some idea of how to make this a product that's going to meet high ethical standards. That's usually not a concern when people are trying to make this type of product. And
because it's about money.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this a critique of capitalism in some way? Seriously,
sure. You know, I would never endorse a free market. I think that there always has to be some sort of guiding, you know, humanity that regulates what we want out of our products, which isn't necessarily, you know, a socialist point or a capitalist point. It's the idea that we have to be the creators of our world, and we have to have a vision for the things that are useful for us and aren't useful for us. And we shouldn't sort of give up our critical thinking ever and our autonomy, which is, speaking of autonomy, one of the problems with all of this is that privacy, I think, is tied very intimately to our autonomy and to our liberty. And the more that our lives are open for other people to look into, the more we could be manipulated by those other people and the more we cede our autonomy. And we see that with things like Cambridge Analytics, which took a lot of big data and basically was able to manipulate people and sell them on a product, or a political product in this case. But that's one of the direct dangers, I think, of to the degree we give up our privacy, we risk giving up our autonomy. And there's so much more to say, because we could talk about how this cashes out in the public sphere versus a private sphere. When we're talking about face recognition in terms of products in a store, that's something that maybe we should be able to opt in and out of. But when we're talking about things like security and facial recognition for that, then there's perhaps a greater potential for a lot of good and a lot of public safety, but also a lot of scary sort of, you know, Big Brother style panopticon-like monitoring that we don't want to really get into, I hope, as a society. And then, you know, each of those different spheres may require a different approach, and so it complicates the problem. Thinking of the Lockport example,
yeah.
And I think Scott was probably speaking to this a bit, the more we rely on these technologies, the more we might deaden our sensibilities. And we've probably all heard that facial recognition can be gamed with photographs. So if somebody wants to get past that, clever students are on top of it. I don't, you know, it may be that old-fashioned monitoring of your students with human eyes in terms of their security is a better option. I think sometimes we could innovate ourselves right out of efficiency and effectiveness. And we have to also worry about that.
Yeah, it's clearly a good point. Both of our other guests want to jump in. Steve Jacobs first, go ahead.
So, you know, my iPhone can be unlocked by my fingerprint if I so choose, right? Facial recognition, fingerprints, these things are often getting used in exchange for passwords, right? Because now we don't have to type in our password. Great on some levels. The downside, and kind of as Scott alluded to when he talked about facial recognition, the kind of chain of things that can get things wrong, if somebody steals my password, I can change my password to help prevent identity theft. If the airlines lose their database that connects my name to my face, it's a lot more difficult to change my face for a new password, right? If we use more biometric data as passwords and as tags to our identity, and as we see, we're very bad at protecting our libraries of these pieces of information, our credit card numbers, so on and so forth. You don't necessarily want people to steal your fingerprint as easily as they can steal your credit card number.
Right. And the law makes a distinction between the password and the fingerprint. You know, the government may have more options to put a finger against a phone and get that unlocked than trying to compel a person to get a password. And so, you know, personally, I don't use the fingerprint because I'd rather have the security to say, you know what, you've got to compel me to render up a password.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS. That's Finger Lakes Public Radio. It's 89.5 FM all throughout the Finger Lakes region.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. Stay warm, and we will talk to you Monday.